standards of excellence in today's society, we are confronted with many problems as we seek to minister to young men and women. Problems that are deep-seated and very obscure, ranging from just simple free thinking to complex conceptual ideas and philosophical thinking and teachings. And though I don't understand all of the problems of these cultural influences and social influences and philosophical influences that we have, I do understand the problems that I see they create. And I can speak to those. And I do recognize that some of these problems, though they're age old, it isn't because of some philosophy that was developed this year. The permissiveness and some of these philosophical ideals are really lending to the problems not only of the people that we're working with, but us, our thinking, our standards. I was talking with Tom Darnell this morning during breakfast, and we discussed some of the problems that result from some of these philosophies of today, like dialectical materialism and atheistic existentialism and other such philosophies that have greatly affected the thinking of this generation, both the heathen and Christian societies. And as we discussed this, I was trying to draw out from him to see whether or not he has experienced some of the same problems that I've experienced as a result, I think, of these influences. Now, recently, out of a clipping, I wrote this down on these two particular philosophies that I just made reference to. Dialectical materialism presupposes that matter, not spirit, is behind all reality. And if matter is basic, then nothing precedes it, including God. Thesis versus antithesis. By joining the opposites in interaction, you get a harmonious synthesis. On the other, atheistic existentialism, life is meaningless and man is just an animal who has no purpose in the universe. Man is what he makes himself, Dr. Joseph Crutch said. In an existential painting, this message comes out loud and clear. No matter how you turn it, life is meaningless. Therefore, they have come to the conclusion there can't be a perfect God who wants us to be perfect. Thus, there is no reason to seek truth or perfection. As a result, we are dealing with young men and women who are undisciplined, perverted, fighting authority, bringing God down to man's size, calling him the man upstairs, humanizing God. Thus, anti-achievement, anti-perfection, anti-cleanliness, anti-discipline, anti-absolutes, and anti-moral convictions. Well, I wanted to start out with that to kind of lay the basis on which we're going to try to build the sermon. Because many of us, if not all of us, perhaps through osmosis, have been affected by these philosophies to some extent or another. And we must be ready to deal with these things, not only in our own lives, recognizing these things, recognizing the lowering of our own standards because of these influences, as well as recognizing the problems that those we're working with are confronted with as a result. And I view these problems as being really grave. Now, with God's standards of excellence, we have a great number of passages in the scriptures that tell us what His standards are. And many of them are very, very rigid. Somebody recently said, the set of the sail is determined by the gale. And I changed that a little bit to say, the set of the soul determines the goal. And I believe that our soul must be set on setting our standards high, especially in these days, or we're going to be sucked into these various satanic influences and philosophies. In 1 Corinthians 13, you can turn with me if you'd like, beginning at verse 1. We'll just take a look at what some of God's standards are, and we'll cover a bunch of them in a very short manner of time here. 1 Corinthians 13, 1 through 7. I'm reading in the Living, if you don't mind. Enjoy your translation, whatever it is. If I had the gift of being able to speak in other languages without learning them and could speak in every language there is in all of heaven and earth but didn't love others, I would only be making noise. If I had the gift of prophecy and knew all about what is going to happen in the future, knew everything about everything but didn't love others, what good would it do? Even if I had the gift of faith so that I could speak to a mountain and make it move, I would still be worth nothing at all without love. If I gave everything I have to poor people, and if I were buried alive for preaching the gospel but didn't love others, it would be of no value whatsoever. Love is very patient and kind, never jealous or envious, never boastful or proud, never haughty or selfish or rude. Love does not demand its own way. It is not irritable or touchy. It does not hold grudges and will hardly even notice when others do it wrong. We spoke to that a little yesterday, didn't we? If you really love somebody, it's amazing how much wrong they can do without it really aggravating you. You give them the benefit of the doubt every time because you love them. It is never glad about injustice, but rejoices whenever truth wins out. If you love someone, you will be loyal to him no matter what the cost. You will always believe in him, always expect the best of him, and always stand your ground in defending him. Turn over to Romans, the 12th chapter. Beginning at verse 1. And so, dear brothers, I plead with you to give your bodies to God. Let them be a living sacrifice, holy, the kind He can accept. When you think of what He has done for you, is this too much to ask? Don't copy the behavior and customs of this world, but be a new and different person with a fresh newness in all you do and think. Then you will learn from your own experience how His ways will really satisfy you. As God's messenger, I give each of you God's warning. Be honest in your estimate of yourselves, measuring your value by how much faith God has given you. Verse 9. Don't just pretend that you love others. Really love them. Hate what is wrong. Stand on the side of good. Love each other with brotherly affection and take delight in honoring each other. Never be lazy in your work, but serve the Lord enthusiastically. I'll probably forget this. Let me break in on this. I just shared this last night with a friend. When I was back at Glen Eyrie, I had the opportunity to be responsible for the print shop and had a few men working for me in there. And one day I came in and we had a great big job that we were collating, putting together. And there were tens of thousands of these things that we were putting together. And this young man had only been in there a couple days and he was just kind of putzing along, you know, putting these things together, and looked like he had a lousy attitude, and then he'd plop it down, you know, and then he'd walk slowly to the other end and he'd pick up another stack and plop it down. And so I walked over to him and I said, Bill, who do you work for? He said, oh, I guess I work for you. I said, no, you don't work for me. Well, I suppose I work for the navigators, the leadership. I said, well, in a way, yeah, but that isn't what I'm getting at. Who do you really work for? Finally, he said, well, I guess for God. I said, yeah, if I were you, if you didn't really believe that, I wouldn't stick around here any longer because you're only making $11 a week. And sometimes you don't get that. And that's not much money. So I know you're not sticking around here to make money. So if you're not working for God, you know, I'd find some other place to work. But if you're working for God, I would work like I was right in the presence of the King. And if you were the King, if there were a King, and you were working for the King, and the King came into the room, you would really hustle, wouldn't you? And he admitted that he would. And I said, well, brother, the King of Kings is by your side at all times. And I would really give my heart in working for him. Never be lazy in your work, but serve the Lord enthusiastically. Be glad for all God is planning for you. Be patient in trouble and prayerful always. When God's children are in need, you be the one to help them out. And get into the habit of inviting guests home for dinner, or if they need lodging, for the night. If someone mistreats you because you are a Christian, don't curse him. Pray that God will bless him. When others are happy, be happy with them. If they are sad, share their sorrow. Work happily together. Don't try to act big. Don't try to get into the good graces of important people. But enjoy the company of ordinary folks. And don't think you know it all. Never pay back evil for evil. Do things in such a way that everyone can see you are honest, clear through. Don't quarrel with anyone. Be at peace with everyone, just as much as possible. Oh, we could go on and on with that. But these passages point out a number of God's standards, and we're going to touch on a few of them. The first one is faith. God's standard for Christians, and particularly for disciples, is faith, to be men and women of faith. Now, we know a lot of scriptures that talk about faith. that point out that God is looking for this kind of a man. Hebrews 11, a lot of you already know that chapter. And in verse 6 it says, "But without faith it is impossible to please him. For he that cometh to God must believe that he is, and that he is the rewarder of those who diligently seek him." Now, faith means that you really believe that. It's a part of your being. You really believe that God really rewards those who diligently seek him. And without faith, it's impossible to please him. Years ago, I memorized Matthew 7:7. And, that along with a few other verses, John 14:14, Matthew 7:7, "Ask and it shall be given unto you. Seek and ye shall find, knock and it shall be opened unto you." And I was just young enough spiritually to believe that. You know, when Jesus gave an illustration of faith, he said, look at these little children. Except you have the faith of these little children. Faith of a mustard seed. Dossie gets up on the garage and on the roof, and I say, "Doss, jump." Man, he jumps. He doesn't try to figure out all the calculations on this. Let's see now. Dad doesn't have very big muscles, and with about an 11-inch arm or whatever it is, he doesn't have too much there, and I'm coming down at 33 foot per second or whatever that is, and with gravity pulling, and, you know, odds are Dad's not going to get me. No, he just jumps because he really believes that I'm going to catch him. Ask and it shall be given unto you. Do you really believe that? Now in John 14:14 it says, "If ye shall ask anything in my name, I will do it." Now, as you study that out and you study these portions within their context, you have to inject into this according to God's will. We want God's will, and he answers us according to his will. But we ask in faith. Well, when I went to North Carolina, I traveled across country with an old buggy, a 1952 Dodge that had been given to me. And there was a long story into that that I won't go into, but I was heading across the country, and I had another guy riding with me. And as we got into Wyoming, I was on my way to Colorado Springs. I was en route to North Carolina with this old car. And I started having trouble out there in the middle of nowhere, out in those hills of Wyoming. I hadn't been in a town for 40 miles, and I had no idea how far the next one was. And the car started slowing down, and then it sped up a little, and then it slowed down some more, and I started praying. I started praying out loud. I said, "God, well, you know all about this car. You know that it's kind of having problems right now, and boy, I don't know what's wrong with it." And, you know, it's chugging along. And I pray a little bit louder. "Lord, this car is really not doing too well. It's, I don't have any money. And what little money I have, well, God, it's all yours. The car is yours. My money's yours. I'm yours." And this guy's sitting over here. I completely forgot he was there, you know. And I was pouring my heart out to the Lord on this car. And I said, "Lord, boy, you made all the stuff that goes into this car. And so I know that right now you could stick your finger right in whatever's wrong and just fix it long enough for me to get to Colorado Springs so I don't have to spend money on the car, because, you know, I got my friend Lonnie Martinez back there, and he's manager of that garage, and I start praying a little faster because I was down to about 15 miles an hour now, and I was reminding God that I had Lonnie as a friend there, and that he'd probably fix my car for nothing. And so I said, Lonnie, but whatever your will is, Lord. And then all of a sudden, the car started going faster and chugged back and going faster and chugged back. Finally got up to 60, and away we went. Well, I pulled into Colorado Springs and went directly to Lonnie Martinez's garage. And I pulled the car up in the driveway, and I shut it off, and then I chatted with Lonnie for a while, and then we left. And we got another ride out to Glen Eyrie. And he called me that afternoon, and he said, "Harv, do you know what was wrong with your car?" I said, "No." He said, "Had I not seen you drive that in here, I never would have believed it." I said, "Well, why is that, Lonnie?" He said, "Because the car couldn't run that way." I said, "Well, what do you mean?" He said, "You know anything about a carburetor?" I said, "Nope." He said, "Well, a carburetor," and then he tried to explain it to me, you know. And anyway, I guess there's a plunger assembly of some kind in there, and this whole plunger assembly was completely dismantled, laying around in there some way. And he said the condition that it was in, it was impossible for that to pump gas. And I just said, "Thanks, God." You know, a simple little illustration, but times like that changed my life. It really made me believe God. Now, I can't prove that to anybody, nor do I have to. There's one guy that believes it, and that's that guy that was sitting next to me. And I'm still in touch with him. Men of faith, do you really believe in the sovereignty of God? Do you really have faith in God's absolute sovereignty? I've had a lot of problems, and I could spend a lot of time telling you my problems because I've had a lot of them. And none of my problems are secrets. Because if somebody can learn from mine, I would like them to learn without going through it themselves. I thought I had this nailed down, the sovereignty of God. But 5 years ago, when I returned from Okinawa with my family, and we were to be reassigned in the United States somewhere, I had on my heart very strongly to go to a certain part of the United States. I felt I had leading from God to go there. I felt that I had claimed promises for it. And there was only one problem. The leadership of the navigators didn't feel so led. So I kept waiting for word from the leadership, and I was in the States for about 3 or 4 months before finally at a conference where we had a staff conference, the decision was going to be made on where I was going to end up, and the place I did not want to go of any place in the United States was the East Coast. And the regional directors at that time were meeting together every day, and the subject of where I was to go came up several times, but they could never agree on the spot that God would have me. The morning of the last day, I was out in the woods, and I really went through some very rough times during this week in particular. I was really wrestling, and I thought I knew what I was wrestling with, but what I was really wrestling with was myself. And I was out having my devotions in the woods, and suddenly it occurred to me that I was convinced God wanted me to go to California. But the other directors, 10 or 12 of them, whatever they were, godly men, were not convinced that I should go there. And it occurred to me at that point that I was assuming that I was more capable of determining God's will than these other 10 or 12 godly men together who could determine God's leading for my life. Well, that hit me very hard, and I began to weep, and I asked God to forgive me, and I told him I would go wherever they asked me to go, and I came up out of the woods, and Rod Sargent met me on the road, and he said, "Guess where you're going?" And I said, "I don't know." He said, "Going to the East Coast." And I said, "Great." And he was kind of surprised at my response, because he knew that I'd really had a heart to go to a certain spot in California. But the thing that I really concluded in this struggle was that God is really sovereign, and that God would pave my way. And if he didn't want me out east or some other place, he would work that out. And I ask you, how much do you really believe God? George Bernard Shaw said, "You see things as they are, and you ask, why? But I dream things that never were, and I ask, why not?" Number two, love. The passage we read said, not just pretending to love. You can write down Galatians 3:13 through 15. Won't take time to read that. Ephesians 4:2. "Be humble and gentle. Be patient with each other, making allowance for each other's faults because of your love." Now, I'd like to speak to two things on love, and that's thoughtfulness and a thankful spirit. Thoughtfulness. Not long back, we had one of our teams. I've used this before, and I trust that the people involved will not feel I'm really jumping all over them, but it's an excellent illustration for the point. Often things are borrowed from our house. Things were borrowed from our house for this conference, and I count it a privilege to use everything we have. And so one of the teams decided they'd like to borrow some of our pots and pans because they were going to do some cooking this weekend. And so they did. They went off, and when they came back, they delivered these things at our house. And after, a couple days or so, my wife discovered that we were missing a lid to one of the big pots. Now, the pot is about that big. Bought it on Okinawa. We bought it for our big feasts when we had 100 or some men out for dinner. And it stood about that high, and then it had a lid, same size, you know, about that thick. It was one of these kitchen cooking things, you know, that these great big restaurants have. That's what we had bought. Well, to try to find one of those lids, I imagine, would be a pretty difficult job. Well, when it was discovered the lid was missing, somebody made a call to this other somebody. And this somebody said, "Oh, yeah, well, I guess we must have left it over there." And that was it. Didn't say, "I'm sorry." Didn't say, "Boy, you know, I am really sorry. We will make sure we'll get that. I'll call over there this afternoon and see if they have it. And, boy, you know, I'll take off tomorrow and make a trip to get it." Or nothing. Nothing. I'm sorry. We left it. Now, I'm not saying this to get on anybody. I'm saying this because I think that it's a trend, gang. And it's thoughtlessness. And it's kind of a careless attitude. And it's wrong. At times, things are returned to our place and they're returned dirty or broken. Nothing said. I have a hard time understanding that. At our house one day, I got challenged years ago by Dawson Troutman. I won't go into that story on observation, but it was really a graphic illustration for me that I've never forgotten. A little later, I was living with John Crawford, and I had the same opportunity to learn the same lesson again on observation. And so from time to time, I put that hat on, and I observe how unobservant some of our people are. Well, one day I noticed a piece of paper on our stairway. Just a little piece of paper. And so I decided I'm going to leave that there. I'm going to see if anybody picks it up, and then I'm going to ask later on if it's missing. I'm going to ask who picked it up. Well, on the second day, it was still there. My wife doesn't like me to tell this story. But such a good illustration. Just a little piece of paper, not probably over 3/4 of an inch square. And finally, I picked it up. Well, then I asked different people, did you see this little piece of paper on the step? And one said, nope, never saw it. I said, have you been up those steps in the last 2 days? Oh, yeah. Oh, we've really got a problem. Because this piece of paper has been there for 2 days. And you didn't see it. That's really bad, man. We've got a problem with observation. Another one says, yeah, I guess I saw it. And I said, why didn't you pick it up? Well, I don't know. I said, when you're going up the steps, you don't even have to bend over to pick up a piece of paper. Just reach down. And the problem is the heart and the standard of the heart. And I'm not suggesting that you got to run around the house every day looking for little pieces of paper. Nor am I suggesting as you walk down the dorm that you pick up every beer can and, you know, that's laying around in the hall. But in your room, if there's a piece of paper on the floor, you ought to pick it up. What's your standard? Thankful spirit. I got to jump over some of this. We'll never get through. Got 12 more of these subjects to go. They're not quite this long, though. A thankful spirit. Recently, a fellow navigator and I were chatting, and he was telling me about one of his staff that he goes to visit every few months. And for the last couple of years, he's been visiting this man. And he says, you know, Harv, every time I go to visit this man, he chews me out for not coming to see him more often. And he said, you know, I tell him that, man, I got a lot of other staff that I got to see, and I just can't get down to see you very often. He said, you know, Harv, the thing I discovered, in the 2 years, this man has never thanked me for coming. He's never thanked me for coming. I got a letter from a man not long ago that I poured my life into for several years. Very good friend. Very close. Lived with us. And this letter went on and on, several pages, about criticizing me for not helping him in the way that he thought I should have, or helping him in the way that I might have helped somebody else or something, and the whole letter was critical. And never once in the letter did he say, thank you. Thank you for pouring your heart into my life, even though you did such a lousy job of it. I tried. I did my best. Got a letter the other day from a man. I spoke up at the New England conference about a week ago. And I got a letter from one of the young troops up there. I don't know who he is. And it was just a short letter, and he just thanked me over and over and over for my investment in his life, because I preached two messages up there and God used it to change his life. And he wrote me to thank me. One day, two messages, and the guy wrote me to thank me. The other guy poured my life into for years, and all he did was criticize. Last week I got a letter from some of the most dear friends we have, Mr. and Mrs. Lyle Choate. Many of you know Barbara Choate, she's here with us. And Ken Choate, most of you know, who was with us here on the East Coast, now with the China Task Force. Got a letter last week from the Choates. And it was through Ken's life that his whole family have come to know Christ as their Savior. The whole bunch of them. Took years. But every one of them, one by one. And Mrs. Choate just wrote and said, Harvey, we can't thank you enough for the way God has used you in our family. Do you have a thankful spirit? Or are you all wrapped up criticizing? That's love. I just came from my dad's funeral a couple weeks ago, and the preacher had this to say about Dad, and I just jotted a few things down during the ceremony while tears were rolling down my cheeks. It was really a glorious moment. My dad was a believer and had brought us up in a very good Christian home and good Christian church. And this is what he said about my dad. He said, Arvid was a person who has become a part of our life. He's a man we love, a man known by his faith. It's hard to speak of a person like this who has loved you and whom you have loved so much. His life revealed what he believed. He was a source of strength and encouragement. Arvid was a man who loved. He loved God, he loved life, and he loved to serve others. His life ended like he lived, surrounded by love and friends. Number three, honesty. God is looking for honest men. In Exodus 18:21, he's looking for men of truth. You're driving down the road and all of a sudden, and you pull over and behind you this red light's going and the guy comes out of his car and he comes up to your window and he says, "Hey buddy, how fast were you going?" How much does it take to make you tell a lie? $5? $10? Honesty. Always. Part of the fiber of your being. I am the way, the truth, and the life. And Jesus dwells within us. And every time we hedge on the truth, we dishonor his name. Excuses. When you're cornered, and your leader, or somebody has got the rap on you, what do? Hedge? Make excuses? Tell half the truth? Number four, discipline. God's standard of discipline. James 4:17. He that knoweth to do good and doeth it not, to him it is sin. You know, it's kind of hard to bend. These standards. It's sin, gang. And this discipline has got to come out of the heart. It isn't something we just force. It isn't something we just put on. It's because of what God is doing in our hearts. In a book called Forever Triumphant by Hugel. It's a great book. If you've never read it, I would encourage you to get it. This is a quote from that book. "It is not victory now with clenched fist and set jaw. It is a victory in the midst of 10,000 hallelujahs. It's victory in the midst of a positive walk with Jesus Christ, in a victorious life with him. It isn't, boy, I'm going to do it if it kills me." I can't go into that any further. I'd love to, but I can't, or we'll never get through here. Some years ago, I clipped out a little thing that I think will help illustrate here by Charlie Brown. I've used this at times. Some of you have more than likely heard it. I wish I could flash it up on the screen. You in the back could see it a little better. And I took this out of a series of 4 days right around Christmas time. And I'll read it to you. You get the gist. The first day, Linus is out there with Charlie Brown and they're making a snowman. And Charlie Brown says, "I shouldn't be outside playing like this. I should be inside reading Gulliver's Travels and writing a book report." Linus says, "It's good for you to be outside, though. You need the fresh air." Charlie Brown says, "You're right, I do." So he's rolling another snowman. He says, "Good old wishy-washy Charlie Brown." The second day, He's standing in the living room and he says, "Christmas vacation is almost over. I still haven't written my book report on Gulliver's Travels. I haven't even started to read it. Why don't I get started? Why do I put things off?" And then he sits down in a big easy chair in front of the TV set and he says, "What's wrong with me?" Third day, Linus is standing outside. He says, "Hurry up, Charlie Brown, you'll be late for school." And then he says, "I wonder if he read Gulliver's Travels and wrote his book report." As Charlie Brown comes, he says, "Did you finish it, Charlie Brown? When did you do it?" And Charlie Brown, all disheveled and his eyes are crossed, it says, "At 3 o'clock this morning." The last day, Linus is watching Charlie Brown come back from school. And he says to Charlie Brown, "What grade did you get on your book report, Charlie Brown?" And Charlie says, "D minus." That's as low as you can get without failing. The teacher said it looked like the sort of report that was written after midnight on the last day of Christmas vacation. What could I say? I congratulated her on her remarkable perceptivity. Well, that's about how disciplined many of us are. In the morning, you get up to have devotions, and you look at your Bible, and you just don't feel like it. And you sit there trying to decide, you're late anyway, and you got so many things to do, and you've got so many things on your mind, and you grab the Bible and you can't open it. And you grab it and it's just like trying to lift 500 pounds before you get it open. And you really are, because Satan is sitting on it. But once you get it open, it's glorious, isn't it? It feeds the soul like nothing else. But it takes a little discipline to open it up, doesn't it? And you know what? In this day of permissiveness, discipline is not very popular. And you and I are going to have to fight the current of social trends of our day. Purity. Romans 7:14 through 21. This is one of my favorite passages. A lot of people don't like it because they don't understand it. And I may not understand it either, but I like it. "For we know that the law is spiritual, but I am carnal, sold under sin. For that which I do, I allow not. For what I would, that do I not. But what I hate, that do I. If then I do that which I would not, I consent unto the law that it is good. Now, when it is no more I that do it, but sin that dwelleth in me. For I know that in me, that is in my flesh, dwelleth no good thing, for to will is present with me, but how to perform that which is good, I find not. For the good that I would, I do not, but the evil which I would not, that I do. Now if I do that I would not, it is no more that I that do it, but sin that dwelleth in me. And I find a law then, that when I would do good, evil is present with me." Galatians 5:19. If you don't mind, I'll read this in the Living. "But when you follow your own wrong inclinations, your lives will produce these evil results: impure thoughts, eagerness for lustful pleasure, idolatry, spiritism, that is, encouraging the activity of demons, hatred and fighting, jealousy and anger, constant effort to get the best for yourself, complaints and criticisms, the feeling that everyone else is wrong except those in your own little group, and there will be wrong doctrine, envy, murder, drunkenness, wild parties, and all that sort of thing. Bishop Hall said, "Many have yielded to go a mile with Satan who never intended to go two, but once on their way have been unable to leave his company. There are many who live in open profaneness who never thought they'd sink to such a low level, but Satan beguiled them with modest beginnings." I think this poem kind of describes this. "Once I bought my boy an engine that could circle round and round, for I knew he'd be so happy when his electric train he found. Like a boy myself, I set it going neath the Christmas tree, all my dignity forgotten as I watched in childish glee. Then I stopped, I tried to mend it. Then it stopped, I tried to mend it, turned it here and punched it there. But my knowledge of mechanics found no trouble anywhere. I was disappointed sorely, as I knew the boy would be. Then I spied a glittering something that had fallen from the tree. Surely that wee bit of tinsel on the rail no harm had done. But I brushed it off, and presto, how that train began to run. Just a little bit of something shiny, something harmless in its place. But it makes all effort fruitless. There's no power for the race." Many of you have heard me use the short story by Edgar Allan Poe on the black cat, so I won't repeat that. It's kind of a gory thing. But he loves this little black cat, and he pets it, and they become very good friends. And then he begins to hate it. And then he tries to get rid of it, but the thing sticks with him, and it haunts him until the day he dies. Little beginnings. Satan beguiles us with little beginnings. 1 John 2:15 and 16. "Love not the world, neither the things that are in the world. If any man love the world, the love of the Father is not in him. For all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eye, and the pride of life is not of the Father, but is of the world." 1 Thessalonians 5:22, "Abstain from all appearance of evil." When you see the evil way down there, abstain from it. Or in Proverbs 4:14 and 15, it says, "Avoid it, pass not by it, turn from it and pass away." How do you do on purity? How about the magazines? Your thought life. Do you just let it go on and on and on? And you just kind of meditate on it and let it eat your heart out? What's your standard on purity? Not just an act. How about your mind? What kind of defenses have you set up to assure you're having a pure mind? Covetousness. Part of purity, I think. In Exodus 18:21, it says, "Hating covetousness." Men who hate covetousness. When on Okinawa, there was a young man by the name of Eddie. He was in our advanced Bible study. He was really coming great, and he just led a couple guys to the Lord. And he had asked me at one time what I thought about his buying a camera. He wanted to get a camera. And so I said, "Well, I think it's a good idea. What kind you think?" So he named some kind, you know, Petrix or whatever those things are, and it happened to be about a $500 camera. I said, "Man, what are you going to get one of those for? Why don't you get one like mine? I only paid $22 for it." He says, "Well, that's not very good." I said, "Man, Glenn thought it was pretty good. He took pictures of the world with the thing up in outer space. You know, a Minolta. It only cost $22 over there. And so, you know, it must have done all right. And so he said, well, I'd like one that, you know, it's got all this stuff on it. And I said, well, man, I'd pray about it. And, well, we talked about it 2-3 times. And all of a sudden in this one Bible study, he stood up and he said, why do you always talk about having, about my camera? Why, this whole study, all you've talked about is my camera and why I shouldn't have my camera. And he said, I'm getting sick and tired of it. And I said, Eddie, I haven't thought one time tonight about your camera. You're lying! And he took off. Never came back. And I really believe that Eddie got out of the battle, and he's likely out of the battle today because of a camera. His heart lusted after that camera. And some of you say, boy, is that stupid? Well, it's not so stupid when you think of some of the things you lust after. I had a friend in North Carolina, a businessman that was a friend of Jim Webster's. And this man told me a story once about how on his way to work, he went by a certain boat store. And every day he saw this boat coming and going. He'd look at that boat. One day he decided to stop and just look at it right there at the window. And he went in and just kind of touched it, you know, and then he left. And a few days later he stopped again and went in and asked the salesman how much it cost. And so the salesman told him $4,000 or whatever it was. And, oh, man, I could never do that. But daily, back and forth, back and forth. He stops in again and he says, what would the payments be on a thing like this? And so the salesman told him and he said, oh, man, I'd have to hock everything I've got. And he said, man, I'd have to take a second mortgage on my house and et cetera, et cetera. And I couldn't do it. So he left. One day he came in there and he, in almost a rage, and he says, I'll buy it. And he bought it, and he went into hock. He second mortgaged his home and the whole works because he lusted after that boat. Covetousness. Lot and his wife were escorted out of the city by these angels, told them get out of there before it was too late. And they gave one little warning, don't look back. And Mrs. Lot goofed. And the reason she looked back, I think, was because she coveted that way of life. She didn't want to leave it. In Joshua 7:1, we see the story of Achan. It's often referred to as Achan's sin. And they'd been given the instructions from God that when they went in and tore up a city that they weren't supposed to take anything out of there. No jewels, no money, nothing. They were supposed to burn it all. Well, they had just gotten through taking this city and they were out here pitched in their tents and Joshua sent a few of his men out to kind of knock off a little town and they got defeated. And Joshua couldn't believe it. And he got down on his hands and knees and in sackcloth and ashes and wept before God and asked God what in the world was wrong. And God just said, there's sin in the camp. So Joshua decided he better figure out where it was. So he went to work, and in those days they used dice a lot, or similar to that. They called them lots. And to figure out where the problem was. And God helped them through these means to discover that the problem was right down to Achan's family. He went in and asked him, you know, what are you guilty of? And Achan finally confessed. He said, well, when I saw all that treasure, I wanted it. And so I took it. Now, it's interesting that with Eve, she saw it, she lusted it after it, because it looked good to eat, and because it was going to make her as wise as God. That's what Satan said. And John writes, love not the world, neither the things that are in the world, for all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eye, and the pride of life is not of the Father, but is of the world. And that's what Achan was guilty of. But covetousness, he lusted after it. 6, faithfulness. Luke 10:16-10. Sorry, he that is faithful in that which is least is faithful also in much. And under this would come dependability, wouldn't it? And I'll tell you, gang, it is hard to get a person that you can really depend on. And when you're in any kind of a leadership position, which many of you are, you know what I'm talking about. You'll get the answer back when it hasn't taken place. You never told me. Or, I forgot. And it's kind of, there is no taking the responsibility for it whatsoever. Kind of hedging around it. Oh, it wasn't my fault. And in Psalm 12:1, David says, Lord, help, godly men are fast disappearing. Where in all the world can dependable men be found? I'd like to illustrate that a little more, but I don't have time. 7, obedience. In Jeremiah 7:22-23, God says, for I spake not unto your fathers, nor commanded them in the day that I brought them out of the land of Egypt concerning burnt offerings and sacrifices, but this thing commanded I them, saying, obey my voice, and I will be your God, and ye shall be my people, and walk in all the way that I have commanded you, that it may be well unto you. Now God says, to obey is better than sacrifice. Skip Gray changes that a little. He says, to obey is better than to be sacrificed. But here he parallels this with what was really a holy activity. The feasts and the sacrifices. And God says to obey is much greater than the sacrifices. And he says, I've commanded you to obey my commands. In Acts 5:1, we see how God deals with somebody who purposely disobeyed. And that was Achan, Ananias and Sapphira in Acts 5. And you remember they lied. And they lied not only to the Christians, but they were lying to the Holy Spirit, and they were both killed. Achan and his family in Joshua 7. As a result of their sin, they weren't just forgiven on the spot. Well, you know, everybody makes their mistakes. God bless you, you know, try not to do it again. They took them outside the city. God told them to stone them, every one of them, the wife, the children, and all their cattle and the whole works. God does not play around with the standards that He has given us very clearly. And we're confronted with the philosophy of, well, if you don't feel like doing it, don't do it. Because if you do, you'll be a hypocrite. I've talked to people that have said, boy, Harv, you know, I don't give because I don't have the right motive. My heart isn't in it, and as long as my heart isn't in it, you know, it won't be blessed of God anyway. And another guy says, Harv, I didn't do my Bible study this week. I said, why not? He said, well, I found that my motive was to please you. And the first time around, I didn't know how to answer that. You know, I thought, well, that's right. You shouldn't do it to please me. So, but after I thought about that a little bit, I realized that both of us had been gravely deceived. And I'd like to make this statement that I think will explain the solution for this kind of a problem. When a guy says, I don't feel my motive is right, and therefore I will not do it. And here's a statement. It's a command of God. When conviction crosses God's commands, obey His commands, not your convictions. When conviction crosses God's commands, obey His commands, not your convictions. And God has made many of these things very clear to us, what His commandments are. He has commanded us to hide His word in our heart, to study it, to live by it, for it to be part of our life, to eat it. He's commanded us to give. You don't have to worry about, well, you do need to worry about your motive. But if your motive is not right, that doesn't mean that you have the option to not give or not do Bible study. You got to get your heart right. So keep giving, keep doing Bible study, and trust God to change your rotten heart. 8, humility. Isaiah 66, 1 and 2. To this man will I look, even to him that is of a humble and contrite spirit and that trembleth at my word. James 4:10, humble yourselves in the sight of the Lord, and He shall lift you up. 1 Peter 5:5 and 6, likewise, ye younger, submit yourselves unto the elder, yea, all of you be subject one to another. And be clothed with humility. For God resisteth the proud, but giveth grace to the humble. Humble yourselves, therefore, under the mighty hand of God, that He may exalt you in due time. God's standard for His disciple is humility, a humble man. And I ask you, how humble are you? Rebuke, number 9. Today's philosophy is permissiveness. Boy, you see it in children. I see it quite often where people, Christian parents as well, they don't rebuke or correct their children at all. And in my days of youth, which was a little while ago, the philosophy of rearing children was permissiveness. No more spanking when they go into one of these temper tantrums. Just let them have their tantrum. Let them squirm all over the floor and flip and flop and scream, and they'll get tired of it after a while, and, you know, it'll be okay. They'll finally realize that it's not going to get them anywhere by just flopping around on the floor and screaming. Well, you know what? That's why we've got a lot of flopping, screaming kids today running all over the country. Because nobody out of love, rebuked him. Fred D. Armand said this: straight-thinking realists believe the crime wave traces more than anything else to a new permissive spirit. We are in the midst of a veritable orgy of uncritical altruism. It implies a renunciation of all discipline. Ken Choate, while he was living with me, one day he said, "Harv, you haven't rebuked me for quite a while." He said, "Why?" I said, "Well, Ken, one reason is because I didn't feel you were up to it. I didn't feel I could rebuke you and that you could take it." He said, "Well, Harv, you know, when you go a few months without rebuking me, I feel that you don't love me anymore." In Revelation 3:19, it says, "As many as I love, I rebuke and chasten. Be zealous, therefore, and repent." Number 10, seeking counsel. Boy, we could go over this one, but we'll just touch on it. Proverbs, and if you want to scurry through this, you can, but I'm just going to read a few verses. Proverbs 1:5. "A wise man will hear and will increase learning, and a man of understanding shall attain unto wise counsels." Verse 25. "But ye have set at naught all my counsel, and would none of my reproof. I also will laugh at your calamity. I will mock when your fear cometh." Verse 30. "They would none of my counsel. They despised all my reproof. Therefore shall they eat of the fruit of their own way and be filled with their own devices." Chapter 2, verse 1. "My son, if thou wilt receive my words and hide my commandments with thee, so that thou incline thine ear unto wisdom and apply thine heart to understanding, yea, if thou criest after knowledge and liftest up thy voice for understanding, if thou seekest her as silver and searchest for her as for hid treasures, then shalt thou understand the fear of the Lord and find the knowledge of God." Chapter 5, verse 11. And thou mourn at the last when thy flesh and thy body are consumed, and say, "How have I hated instruction, and my heart despiseth reproof, and have not obeyed the voice of my teachers, nor inclined mine ear to them that instruct me." Chapter 9, verse 8. "Reprove not a scorner, lest he hate thee. Rebuke a wise man, and he will love thee. Give instruction to a wise man, and he will be yet wiser. Teach a just man, and he will increase in learning. For by me thy days shall be multiplied, and the years of thy life shall be increased." Chapter 10, verses 17 and 18. "He is in the way of life that keepeth instruction, but he that refuseth reproof erreth. He that hideth hatred with lying lips, and he that uttereth a slander is a fool." And chapter 15, verse 12. By the way, there are over 100 passages in Proverbs on counsel, and it'd be an interesting study for you sometime. "A scorner loveth not one that reproveth him, neither will he go unto the wise." Which are you, a fool or a wise person? Do you seek counsel or do you shun it? 11, cleanliness. There are all kinds of illustrations here, aren't they? But I think I'll just pass over most of them. But when you're in the bathroom and you shave and you've finished up in there, do you think about the person that's coming in after you? Do you wipe it up? Do you clean it up? Or do you leave it spotted? How about when you have a little snack before you go to bed at night? What do you do with the dishes? Put them in the sink because, oh well, you know, Dodo's wife, she'll take care of it anyway in the morning. How about the clothes you wear? Are they neat? Are they clean? They don't have to be the latest thing out, the sharpest. You may not have money for that. There's no excuse for their not being neat and clean. And in our summer programs this summer, we're going to hit on this. Last summer, we were a little embarrassed by some observations by some that clothes were left strewn all over the place, and it just apparently some of our standards really went to pot on some of our programs as far as the living quarters where guys were staying during the week and also at our summer long programs. What's your standard? When you go away from home, you just kind of, your standards shift into a different gear. See, if they do, then they're not really embedded in your heart, are they? Dawson Trotman said, "Let me look into the dresser drawers of a man and I'll tell you what kind of a man he is." How about your dresser drawers? How about mine? My wife takes care of mine. 12, training. Abraham was not exactly a fighter. You know, he's not famous for being a fighter. But somewhere he figured it out that someday he might have to fight. And when Lot got kidnapped and run off, Abraham took after him with 318 trained men out of his own house. Now, that's a lot of people in one house. But I imagine he meant, you know, in his area. And but he had trained them. And obviously he had a heart for training. David's men. Oh, man, we could go on and on and on this, but you've heard so many messages on training. The point is, God has got a standard for the training of men. And boy, let's not lighten up on our standards for training. The basics. Boy, we could go on and on this, couldn't we? We've got to remember that we are not little gods. We are not self-sufficient. In order to maintain standards of excellence, we must maintain an intimate relationship with Jesus Christ, and that through the Word and through prayer. Because without Him, gang, without Him, we really can't do anything. That's what he told us. Without me, you can do nothing. Good. Sometimes we fail to really believe that. But that's got to be a conviction of our heart. And for us to maintain standards, there is only one way we will and can, and that's through an intimate relationship with Christ. Number 14, and I think this is the last one.
a finisher. Being a finisher. Some of you were finished a while ago. Cheer up, I'm almost done. Being a winner or being a finisher. Let me read one of my favorite passages. 1 Corinthians 9, verses 24 through 26. I like this particularly in the Phillips translation, but I don't have that with me, so I'll read it in this one. Know ye not that they which run in a race run all? But one receives the prize, so run that ye may obtain. And every man that striveth for the mastery is temperate in all things. Now they do it to obtain a corruptible crown, but we an incorruptible. I therefore so run not as uncertainly, so fight I not as one that beateth the air, but I bring I keep under my body and bring it into subjection, lest that by any means, when I have preached to others, I should myself be a castaway. And Paul had some standards for himself to be a finisher, to be a winner. In Philippians 3:14, he says, I press toward the mark. Bear Bryant wrote an article, or had an article written up on him in a recent magazine. And he's not the most profound, but he says some very interesting things. Bear Bryant is a great football coach down in Alabama. He says, I ain't nothing but a winner. He's not the most humble. Now, let me just give one more quote from back here. They asked him, will they have to ask you to quit like they did Adolf Rupp? He says, I'm going to make that decision. No one else. I don't take any abuse from anybody. You can count on that. But as long as I'm getting those chills up my back, as long as I feel I'm contributing, know I'm contributing, I'll be around. How will you know for sure you're contributing? By winning. That's the only thing. There's nothing else. How finely would you want to be remembered when it's over? That I contributed something, that I helped somebody along the way, and that I won the national championship this year. Big grin. But you've already won three. What could one more matter? You just want another after that. And he says, I just want one every year. I ain't nothing but a winner. Ron Clark, in an interview, recently said, front running is the ultimate test, irrevocable commitment to see the race through to the end, or it cannot satisfy your and justify your effort. Some of you have heard these before, but at this point I'd like to read a couple of them again because I think they really are descriptive. So a little review, if you don't mind. Turkey's Kazım Hardname, 27 years old, won a gold medal for his country by beating Romania's Hardname for the lightweight championship in Greco-Roman wrestling. The 154-pound bull-necked construction worker recalls as he stood on the awards platform to receive his medal, I realized that I had never been out with a girl to dance or hold hands or watch the moon. Sounds like somebody I know. No drinking, no smoking, just wrestling from morning to night and dreaming about that gold medal all the time. Al Order won gold medals in the discus throw in 1956 and 1960 Olympics, but suffered internal hemorrhages and torn rib cartilage in a workout just before the Tokyo Games. For a week, doctors gave him heat treatments, ultrasonic massages, muscle relaxers, and other hard-name things to clear up dead internal blood. Stiffly taped on the outside and shot full of painkillers on the inside, he was unable to get throwing leverage from his hips, yet managed to heave the platter 200 feet, 1.5 inches, to win. Any other man would have been hospitalized. Said Order, "These are the Olympics. You die for them." Don Scholander, the top winner with 4 gold medals, that's been surpassed a little bit in this last one, trained 5 hours a day, every day, for 8 of his 18 years. "The greatest sensation in swimming," he said, "is the pain you have to swim through. But the real thrill is winning, and winning big." After defeating France's world record holder, some hard name, and setting a new Olympic record of 53.4 seconds in the 100-meter freestyle, Scholander recalled, "I had nothing left at the finish, not a drop, not a single breath." That's a winner. That's a finisher. And these are glamorous stories about great athletes. But gang, God is writing down the details of glorious events in His great disciples. And that's you and me. And He's got some great standards for us to live by. And if we don't, it's going to create the effect, the results. Billy Graham recently said, "The seeds of integrity, obedience, righteousness, and honesty are not dead, but we are not allowing them to germinate." In Titus 2, 7 and 8. He writes, "And here you yourself must be an example to them of good deeds of every kind. Let everything you do reflect your love of the truth and the fact that you are in dead earnest about it. Your conversation should be so sensible and logical that anyone who wants to argue will be ashamed of himself because there won't be anything to criticize in anything you say." To live above reproof. In Exodus 18:21, I've referred to that a few times, but as Moses picked out his leaders, there was a standard that he was to use. And this was it: "Moreover, thou shalt provide out of all this people able men, such as fear God, men of truth, hating covetousness."